Okay, you're going to notice immediately I'm far less organized than Tom is. He's one of the most organized teachers I've ever seen before. Not to mention, I started about 9:30 last night. So we are in Colossians chapter 3. Tom has been describing that Paul has been on a theme of the preeminence of Christ. And so he's been going through the preeminence of Christ, not only in the assertion of it, but also in the defense of it. And what we kind of talked about yesterday was how there's going to be objections to that, and there's going to be those who are standing against it. He went over, you know, the Judaizers and the Gnostics and those who might be standing against the doctrines of Christ. And so what I want to do this morning, I've kind of chosen kind of a central theme, but if you go to chapter 2, beginning in verse 1, chapter 2, beginning in verse 1, I want to note that Paul is going to stress multiple times the critical role that love is going to play in this whole process. In chapter 2, verse 1, "For I would that ye knew what great conflict I have for you and for them at Laodicea, and for as many as have not seen my face in the flesh." So he introduces chapter 2 by saying there's this conflict he has for this congregation. He's going to go into the first matter that has caused conflict within him in verse 2, that their hearts might be comforted, being knit together in love. So the conflict he has in chapter 2 as he begins this section is, with all these matters of the preeminence of Christ and all those who are going to object and stand against it, my heart struggles because, since I can't see your face right now, I don't know how much love is playing out in this scenario. So what we're going to see here in chapter 3, I think, is the central theme of love is going to be that is going to play a very, very important role in making sure that he gets through not only these objections and they get through this faith and they get through the understanding and preeminence of Christ. So as you enter into chapter 3, if you'll go to chapter 3 with me, in the first 7 verses in Colossians chapter 3, in the first 7 verses, he's going to represent the two options that someone can have. He says, "If ye then be risen with Christ, seek those things which are above, where Christ sitteth on the right hand of God. Set your affection on things above, not on things on the earth. For ye are dead, and your life is hid with Christ in God. When Christ, who is your life, shall appear, then shall ye also appear with him in glory. Mortify therefore your members which are upon the earth, fornication, uncleanness, inordinate affection, evil concupiscence, and covetousness, which is idolatry, for which things sake the wrath of God cometh on the children of disobedience, in the which ye also sometime when ye also walked sometime when ye lived in them." So the first 7 verses deal with the two options that someone has. Those two options are where your affections are. One option is your affection can be on earth. He's going to identify what it means to have your affection on earth. Those who have affections on earth are those who are alive to sin still. They haven't put sin to death. They're still living under the rule of sin. In fact, in verse 7, it says, "Ye lived in them." So you have one option of living in sin. And by the way, I do want to point out in this list in verse 5, those are things that you can live in. That's why we talk about living in adultery and living in fornication, because the Bible clearly says that's something that someone can live in. That is, you stay in that state of that sin until you mortify that thing, until you put it to death. That is one option for someone, and that is someone whose affection's on earth. And by the way, if you have an affection on future earth, you fall into this category. Because he's going to contrast that with your affections being the second option, affections being above. And he makes it very clear in verse 2. You have to set your affections above. The result of that is going to be alive to Christ. Another way of putting that is you are saved. That is the other option. You're either affections on earth and you're dead and alive to sin. You're dead to Christ and alive to sin. Or your affections above, you're alive to Christ and you are saved. Go with me to Deuteronomy chapter 30. One of the verses that stands out there is that he says that Christ is our life. Deuteronomy chapter 30. And I want to point out, because Deuteronomy is going to make a very similar, if not the identical, expression here. And I think it's going to describe for us what it means as to Christ being our life. In Deuteronomy chapter 30, go with me to verse 20. Deuteronomy 30 and verse 20. He says that thou mayest love the Lord thy God, and thou mayest obey his voice, thou mayest cleave unto him, for he is thy life. He is thy life. Does everybody see that? Now, I want you to note what he goes on to say in this description of he is thy life. And the length of thy days, that thou mayest dwell in the land which the Lord swearing to thy fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob, and give them. There's two aspects of this God being their life that I want to point out is described in this verse. There's the physical life aspect. You are alive and you will be continue to be alive because of God. So when he says the length of your days, he's talking about the very fact that you have life has its origins in God. Now remember what we talked about in Colossians chapter 1. Not only did Christ create all things, but he described the fact that by him all things what? Consist. Continue to live and exist. So you have a certain aspect of your life is Christ. From the aspect of the fact that the very fact that we're here, the fact that you woke up this morning, the fact that we are alive, the fact that we continue to live is found in God, is found in Christ. The second aspect, though, if you go back to verse 20, that thou mayest love the Lord thy God. Notice the love connection there. That thou mayest obey his voice, thou mayest cleave unto him. The second aspect of Christ being your life is he is literally your purpose for living. He is your spiritual purpose for living. So not only are you alive because of him, he is the reason you are alive. And he gives you purpose spiritually for the life that you live. So he not only sustains our life, Colossians 1 verse 17, but he also is our purpose for living. And if you have another purpose for living, Paul is commending and instructing and exhorting, go back to Christ being your purpose in all that you do for the life that you have right now. If Christ is not your purpose, put him as your purpose. That's why you're here. You can do all these other things on the side, get a job, have a family, those things. But your ultimate spiritual purpose in this life is Christ, is to live for Christ, to live for God. So back in chapter 3, those are your two options in Colossians chapter 3. You can be alive to sin and have your affections on earth, or you can have your affections above and in fact be alive to Christ and be saved. Christ who is your life. I think that's a remarkable verse in Colossians 3 verse 4. There's a transition in Colossians 3 and verse 8. And this where this section, the next section, where I spend most of our time. In Colossians 3, verse 8, you have a transition. He says, but now ye also. So I want to focus in on three of those words. We have but now. So but now is the way they used to be in verse 7 versus the way they are now. So when you see but now, he means now that you're a Christian. Now that you've put those things off, now that you're a Christian, he's entering into this section by identifying that's not you now. It was you then, but it's not you now. So this would be the stage, in fact, that we are in, those of us who are Christians in this room are in. Ye are a new man now, you've put off the old man. He says ye there, but now ye. Now the ye in the immediate context is, of course, the church at Colossae. But I want to point out in chapter 4, verse 16, and when this epistle is read among you, cause it to be read also in the church of Laodiceans. This, by implication, means this isn't just the church of Colossae, it's Christians. He's talking about Christians, but now Christians. That equally applies to us because he wasn't just saying this is just for Colossae. He's saying this is going to be read in other churches. This is just a church thing here. So but now ye, not only Christians at Colossae, but by extension also any Christian. And then he says, but now ye also. So the also means he has just expressed in verse 5 a list of things that they had to put off. But what he's saying is, I'm not done yet. This list of things is not exhausted. The list I've just gone through is not exhausted. These are a lot of things you need to put off. But also, he's going to go into some other things. Since we are a new man and since we're a Christian, this is how we ought to conduct ourselves. And so he's going to go into also things that are additional to what he has just described in verse 5. Now, I will note some of the things that are described in verse 5 are, I think, a future panel like fornication. And so we're not going to spend a lot of time on that in this class. But those are things that were put away. And then he's going to go into also some additional things that need to be put away. So that's going to be as we start into this section here. So go with me to chapter 3, verse 8 and 9. I want to note the first thing, the first thing also you need to put away. In chapter 3, verses 8 and 9, Christians should give attention to their tongue. By tongue, of course, we mean their speech. Christians should give attention to their speech. In chapter 3, verses 8 and 9, but now ye also put off all these. So that's where the also comes in. Anger, wrath, malice, blasphemy, filthy communication out of your mouth. Lie not one to another, seeing that you put off the old man with his deeds. So he says also, in addition to the list in verse 5, also these are the other things we need to be put off. You need to give attention to your tongue, your speech. Look in James chapter 3. James 3 is perhaps the most famous context for which scripture will go into the importance of a Christian, a new man, someone who's put off the old ways, is to control himself, and that matters in the tongue. In James 3 and verse 8, he says, but the tongue can no man tame, it is an unruly evil full of deadly poison. Now some people read that verse and they'll reach a conclusion, that means it's inevitable. I cannot avoid sinning by my tongue. And if we reach that conclusion, you need to go back and read James again. Because James has already expressed the fact that we can be a perfect means mature, not sinless, but mature Christian, and control the tongue. So what he's saying here is not that it's impossible to control the tongue. The unruly evil in the Greek has to do with the idea, and I mentioned this before, it's the idea of a caged animal. And if you've ever been to the zoo, and you, particularly the big cats, and they're walking back and forth in that cage, the one thing on their mind is, I want to get out of this cage. That's the idea from the Greek. So it's unruly because it's restless. It wants to get out. So the idea in James 3 and verse 8 is, it is certainly possible for us to control what we say. Can you imagine if God said, control your speech, but by the way, it's impossible to do it. God's not going to do that. So we certainly can control our speech, but what's being expressed here is, we can't ever let it off its leash, is what I like to say. You always have to keep it on its leash. You can't let your tongue just go off and say whatever it wants, because then it's unruly. It wants to say things that shouldn't be said. What we should always do is keep our tongue on their leash. And what is meant by James 3 and verse 8 is, it didn't matter if you're 15 or 95. You have to keep your tongue on the leash. That's a part of Christian maturity. There's never a point at which you can say, okay, now I can just say whatever I want. In fact, having been to nursing homes and been around older people, sometimes that leash either gets longer or kind of frays and starts to break, and they lose their filter. So certainly you have no excuse, unless you've actually lost your faculties, to just let your tongue off of its leash. It needs to be maintained. That's a part of Christianity. So he says Christians should give attention to their tongue in Colossians chapter 3. The next thing, go back to Colossians chapter 3. And because of time, I normally, when I teach a class, would open it up for questions and comments, but we are pressed for time since we have to get through the whole chapter, and so if there's time at the end, we can certainly open it up for that. In Colossians chapter 3, go with me to verse 12, Colossians 3 verse 12. The next thing that he says is that Christians are going to give attention to their thoughts and their heart. The thoughts in their heart are going to help you with the tongue problem, because if it's not in your heart, it's not going to come out of your mouth. And that's why when you hear these hypotheticals about, what if I'm on the road and I've lived a righteous Christian my whole life, but then right as I, an 18-wheeler comes to hit me, I say a curse word. How'd that curse word get in your heart? That's what the Bible's describing. That shouldn't have come out of your mouth, because if it came out of your mouth, it was in your heart. So if you were this fantastic Christian this whole time, but that word came out of your heart, then you got a heart problem. You got a heart problem. That's what he's saying. To fix this tongue problem, you got to fix the heart problem, because the tongue is going to flow out of the heart. In chapter 3, verse 12, he says, put on therefore as a elect of God, holy and beloved, bowels of mercy. Bowels are insides. Kindness, humbleness of mind. That's heart. Meekness, long-suffering, forbearing one another and forgiving one another. If any man have a quarrel against any, even as Christ forgave you, so also do ye. I want you to note there the emphasis on the mind, the insides. Go down to verse 15. And let the peace of God rule in your hearts. He ends that verse by saying, be thankful. That's an attitude, a heart thing. Verse 16. Let the word of Christ dwell in you. That's in your heart, in your mind. I keep on pointing here, but it's in your mind, your heart. He says, you richly in all wisdom, teaching and admonishing one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing with grace in your hearts to the Lord. That is, my singing, my praise of God, flows from the grace of God in my heart. And sometimes people, because they don't have the grace of God in their heart, they don't keep the grace of God in their heart, perhaps what flows forth from their mouth is not what's being described here, because it's an inside thing. It's a heart thing. So he talks about here the things that are in man. The word of Christ should be in the heart. The grace of God should be in our heart. Kindness, humility should be in our heart, in our mind. Forgiveness, all those things. So Christians should give attention to their thoughts and to their heart. And again, I'm middle-aged. But I don't think there's ever a time in the rest of your life where you can let your thoughts out of control. Now, some older people can correct me if I'm wrong on that. But when I go through scripture and I realize very quickly that Satan is not a dummy, he's not going to tempt an old person the same way he tempts a young person. And Paul will describe to Timothy the youthful lusts. There are lusts that are very specific to young people that the devil's going to use. But listen, we as older people should not be tempted by those things anymore. We should have moved on. Those should be long in our rearview mirror. But does that mean the devil can't tempt us? No. So if it's not lust of the lust of the eyes, if it's not lust of the flesh, it must be the pride of life as I get older. That's a heart issue. So I think even more so as we get older, we need to pay attention to our thoughts and our minds and our hearts. Because those are the things that we're going to be struggling with. Again, I'm middle-aged, but I presume based on what I read in Scripture, that's the things that we'll be struggling with as we get older. And we shouldn't be struggling with those fleshly things anymore. We can't be childish. We've got to put those things away. So, mind issues, heart issues. Okay, number three, Christians should understand the ultimate role that love plays in all of this. So this is our central verse that I want to kind of use as our springboard for the rest of the class, Colossians 3, verse 14. Again, he's introduced in chapter 2 the connection that love has to all of this. He's going to say it again in chapter 3, verse 14. Above all these things, I don't want you to miss that. Above all these things, everything he's just listed and described, at the very top of it, above all, every single one of them, above all these things, put on, he's been describing things you need to put off. This is the top priority of putting on charity, that's agape love, which is the bond of perfectness. So I want to just stress once again, Paul is emphasizing the critical role that love plays in everything we've been talking about. It's the central heart, the central theme. And I want you to note some of the descriptions there. It says that it is the bond, or it binds. In Colossians 2 verse 19, go back to Colossians 2 verse 19. Not holding the head from which all the body by joints and bands. Same word. The idea there in the Greek is that of ligaments. So, again, I'm not medical, so I like to look at pictures so I can imagine this in my brain. The tendons are what bind the muscle to the bones. Ligaments are what bind the bones to the bones. So he's describing love as the thing that are the ligaments that tie every other aspect of this together. What if I'm missing love? What if our bones were missing ligaments? I'll let you respond to that. What if our bones are missing ligaments? We would just be, there's a medical term. We would just be a pile of bones. Nothing connected, just a pile of bones. The thing that holds the whole picture together is love. That's why he says it's the top, above all other things. If love is missing, nothing else is going to work. This is what Paul is saying. We sometimes don't understand the important aspect, the critical aspect that love plays in this. And this is what Paul is describing here. Look in chapter 2, verse 2. He also mentions in chapter 2 and verse 2 that it's a tie or a rope, a bundle or a load. Colossians 2, verse 2. Well, we read earlier that their hearts might be comforted being knit together in love. So he describes, he uses the language in chapter 3 of ligaments. In chapter 2, he uses the idea of bundling something together or knitting something together. If you take that bundle off of that wheat, what's going to happen? It's all going to be separated and fall apart. If you take, now again, I don't sew. I have to ask my wife about things. But I imagine, based on what my wife has said, if you take that big strand there that knits the whole thing together and you take it out, what's going to happen? It's just yarn again. This is his description of love. It holds the whole thing together. If you're missing love, every single aspect of it falls apart. Go with me to 1 Corinthians chapter 13. 1 Corinthians chapter 13. So he also says, it is the bond of perfectness, or what we might say is maturity. It's that which is the thing that makes you mature. And so a lot of people remain immature because they don't understand, or at least they don't implement, love. It keeps you immature without it. Because love is that which is the perfect bond of maturity. Without it, you're immature. You can have a bunch of other things, but without love, you're still immature. Look in 1 Corinthians chapter 13. 1 Corinthians 13 and verse 1. Look at some of the things that you can have without love. Though I speak with tongues of men and of angels and have not love, so they could have miraculous gifts from the Holy Spirit and not have love. What's the product of that? Vain, useless. Those miraculous gifts become pointless without love. Look in verse 2. Though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, in the context which is miraculous. What if you are an apostle with all the knowledge that God has given to you as an individual? It was always a portion of the gift given to Christ. But that portion that was given to the apostle, what if you had that extended great portion of knowledge without love? It means nothing. It means absolutely nothing. He goes on to say, though I have all faith. Now, all faith in this context is important because there was miraculous faith, and then there is faith that extended beyond the miraculous. And we note that by verse 13. Now abideth faith. So there is the faith that you and I can have. Then there is the miraculous gift of faith. But let's say you have all of that. Let's say in this first century scenario, they were given a gift that resulted in faith, and they had natural faith as a result of the Word of God, Romans 10:17. What if they had all of that? If they didn't have love, it doesn't matter. That's what he's saying. It renders all the faith in the world useless. Look in verse 3. Though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned, I have not love, it profiteth nothing. What if I give to those who are in need? Are you telling me, Paul, that there's a potentiality that I can give to someone and do it without love? That's what he's saying. And I can give everything to the extent of my own body in sacrifice to something, but without love, it becomes an absolutely useless sacrifice. Love is what makes this whole thing possible, necessary, and holds it all together. Does everybody see that? Look at me in 2 Peter chapter 1. And so the other apostles, in addition to Paul, are going to support this idea of love holding it all together. In 2 Peter chapter 1, go with me to verse 5. 2 Peter chapter 1, beginning in verse 5. 2 Peter 1, beginning in verse 5. Peter gives kind of an order here. Beside this, giving all diligence, add to your faith. So we're starting at the foundation of faith. That's the beginning point. Virtue. And to virtue, you add knowledge. That's gnosis in the Greek. I want to bring that up because there's an important distinction here in a moment. You add to your faith virtue, and you to virtue, gnosis, knowledge. And to knowledge, temperance, or self-control. And to temperance, patience. And to patience, godliness. And to godliness, brotherly kindness, phileo love, which has already been mentioned. And to brotherly kindness, love. And notice what the last one is, love. And you're thinking, I thought it was love should be the first one. No, love is the pinnacle of maturity. And people walk around talking about love and throwing around love in an immature state, not understanding that it's the pinnacle that you reach for. And if you don't have any of these things prior, you're not going to attain biblical agape love. It's the pinnacle, it's the apex. He goes on to say, for if these things be in you and abound, if is conditional, they make you that you shall neither be barren nor unfruitful in epignosis. Epignosis is mature knowledge. So you know what we have to do? In our immature state, we have to add knowledge and add knowledge and add knowledge. And our end goal is mature knowledge, epignosis. And where do I find mature knowledge? He's already identified that in verse 3. According as the divine power given unto us, all things that pertain to life and godliness through epignosis. Epignosis, in that verse, is all things that pertain to life and godliness. So until I have matured to that stage, I'm adding gnosis to gnosis to gnosis. And then I'm aiming for mature knowledge in that context. I can never attain that without love. Does everybody see that? I can never attain it without love. 1 Peter, go with me to 1 Peter chapter 4. 1 Peter chapter 4. And all the things that Peter describes in 1 Peter, he gets down to verse 8 and says this, above all things, have fervent love among yourselves. Above all things. Why does it say above all things? Because it is the apex. I can't stress this enough. That's what Paul is getting into. My heart is concerned for you not being there in person because I struggle to determine whether you actually have love there. And if you don't have love there, everything else I'm saying falls apart. It holds a thing together. And so love is this deep thing. It's not just this thing that you claim. This is why we tell people, look, love is more than just a claim. And I know that for wives, because sometimes their love language is, you know, words of affirmation. Wives maybe like to hear that a little bit more than men need to hear it. But if you're not showing it, then we got a problem. If you're not showing love, we've got a problem. You've got to display your love because it's the apex, not the beginning. It is the mature level that we're reaching for in Colossians chapter 3. So Christians should understand the ultimate role that love plays in all this process. And we're going to continue to look at that as we continue. I think this is Paul's emphasis here in this chapter, in the last two chapters, chapter 2 and 3. Amongst all the preeminence of Christ and all those who rise up against it, I think love is at the heart of these things. And he's worried that it's absent. And if it is absent, then there's no purpose in anything else in this book. It's not going to work. You're missing the most vital ingredient. So, an ignorance of biblical love. There is, a lot of people throw around the word love, and I think there's an ignorance of biblical love, and that ignorance of biblical love keeps more people in spiritual immaturity than anything else. An absence of biblical love keeps more people in spiritual maturity than anything else. So I want to look at, as we continue this class, what the Bible has to say about that. So, offering love, here's some aspects of biblical love. Offering love or extending love does not depend on the response of the receiver of our love. It does not depend on the response of the receiver of our love. Look in Colossians chapter 3 and verse 19. Husbands, love, that's agape love, your wives, and be not bitter against them. Agape love is a commandment in this context for a husband, for a wife. And by the way, with the exception of Titus, this is not a commandment of the wife to the husband. It's a commandment of the husband to the wife. The husband is the sacrificial one in the relationship. It should be. You have this sacrificial love of the husband to the wife. So, how I respond in any relationship, we say this in marriage, and this is the example given here, but any relationship, how I respond to someone, whether I extend love or not, does not depend on how they treat me. It doesn't depend on what they give back to me. That's not what my love depends on. When I extend love and someone does not extend love back, I don't stop extending love because it doesn't matter how they respond. Agape love is sacrificial. In fact, if anything, when Paul says, it seems like the more I love you, the less you love me, Paul keeps on loving them more. That's what he's saying. I love you more and more, though it seems like you love me more, less and less. But that didn't stop Paul from loving them more and more. It does not depend on how someone treats me. And so I say oftentimes in marriage counseling, I cannot control how others treat me. I can only control how I respond to them. I cannot control what someone else does. People would like to sometimes, but I can't do it. I cannot control how someone else acts. I can only control how I respond to how they act. That's the only thing I'm in control of. I'm in control of me, or I should be in control of me. That's love. Love is I extend it regardless of how I'm treated or what returns. Look in Romans chapter 13. Paul will describe to the church at Rome the fact that love is something that is owed to someone. We owe it to someone. When you owe something, that means that there's a debt represented. In Romans chapter 13 and verse 8, owe no man anything but to love one another. That's the debt we have. Love one another, for he that loveth another hath fulfilled the law. So here's the question though. I owe love to my brother. Who do I owe it to? Is it because my brother, I owe an debt to my brother necessarily? I don't think so. This is why he says the rest of that verse. He that loveth another hath fulfilled the law. Whose law? My brother's law? God's law. My debt is to God. I love my brother because I'm indebted to God to love my brother. I'm not indebted to you necessarily to love you. I'm indebted to God to love you. That's what I owe God. Why do I owe God to love you? Because what he extended to me first was love. I love others because he first loved me. I owe that to God. And the moment we start to say within ourselves, but you don't understand how someone treats me. Think about how people treat God every single day. Think about how we treat God. Think about how you treat God. Think about how I treat God every day. And then we start griping about what about this person treats me. It doesn't matter. I owe love to them because of God, not because of them. Look in Colossians 3 verse 23. I have three verses written at the beginning of my Bible, and I've done this since three Bibles ago. And I do not switch Bibles readily because I have to copy all my notes over. So this I've had this one for a long time. One of those is Colossians 3:23. It may be my favorite verse in the Bible. Whatsoever ye do, do it heartily. Heartily means your full heart, as to the Lord and not unto men. That's what we're talking about. Love is I'm doing it for the Lord. I'm not doing it for you. Because I'm not going to stand before you on judgment day. I'm going to stand before the Lord on judgment day. My love is expressed to you or should be expressed to you because of the Lord. Is everybody with me? It doesn't matter how you respond to me. I can only control me. And so I extend love back. Colossians 3 verse 23. Go back to Colossians. The next thing I want to note is love puts others before self. Love puts others before self. In Colossians chapter 3, we're going to get to the child-parent relationship in a moment, but I also want you to note in verse 22, the servant-master relationship. A lot of people would have some difficulty in how they treat someone who is over them. And that seems to be, he does this in almost all the prison epistles, doesn't he? He talks about the relationship of master to servant. And that's because apparently a lot of people, and not just people in the first century, but people struggle with that authority under authority relationship. And so I think one of the things that that's going to indicate is an absence of love. Look in Philippians chapter 2. Philippians chapter 2. Love puts others before self. Philippians 2 verse 3. Philippians 2 verse 3. Let nothing be done through strife or vain glory. That's your intent and purpose behind what you're doing. If your purpose is strife, if your purpose is vain glory, don't do it. But in lowliness of mind, which goes back to your thoughts and your mind, let each esteem others better than themselves. Not esteem me better than you, esteem you better than me. That's the Christian mindset. Because I owe love, sacrificial love to you because of God. Colossians 3 verse 23. Look in Titus chapter 3. Titus chapter 3. Not loving others can deliver us to envy. And I think this is one of the things when you look in the, read about in the church, to the church at Corinth, why Paul goes into love. They were envying over spiritual gifts. And what was absent in that whole process was Paul is saying, I don't think you love each other. Based on the way you're treating each other, I don't think you actually love each other. So spiritual gifts aside, there's the problem. The church at Corinth was struggling with it. And there was in fact that envying of one another in Titus chapter 3 verse 3. For we ourselves also were sometimes foolish, disobedient, deceived, serving diverse lusts and pleasures, living in malice and envy. Notice that living in malice and envy. They were continuing in malice, continuing in envy without repenting. Hateful and hating one another. An absence of love. Do you see what results from an absence of love? An absence of love results in malice. That's evil intent. And the absence of love results in envy. We can start to envy one another. When you read about in the warfare language in the book of James, at the end of the book of James, and he's talking about the warfare language, when he talks about you fight and devour and consume one another and go to war against one another, that's an absence of love. Your willingness to do that is an absence of love. And he says this here, it is hating one another. That's an absence of love. Titus chapter 3, verse 3. We know 1 Corinthians 13, verse 4, love envieth not. 1 Corinthians 13, verse 4. But an absence of it, of course, is going to result in envy. Look in Colossians chapter 3, verse 21. Colossians 3, verse 21. What love genuinely does is, it genuinely wants what is best for others. Genuinely, it wants what's best for others. Colossians 3, verse 21. Fathers, provoke not your children to anger, lest they be discouraged. I would encourage you to look up that word discouraged there. It means to be spiritless or disheartened. So I want you to know the relationship of father to child, a father to son, for example. If you want to get me riled up, and I may be exposing too much of myself, but if you want to get me riled up, attack the innocent. That's my big one. You attack a child, I don't even mean physically. If you hurt a child or hurt an old person, like a widow or something, that's going to set me off. So if you want what sets me off, there it is. Because they are defenseless. They don't have someone else to defend them. So that one sets me off. And I go, and I've mentioned before, I study McDonald's sometimes. I do that to kind of keep me alert and keep me awake. And enough happens at McDonald's interesting enough to keep you alert and awake. But one thing I witness almost every time I go there, I'll be sitting there studying, and someone walks in. It's usually you grumpy old people. I'm going to be honest with you. It's you grumpy old people. Some grumpy old person walks in, and who's behind the counter? A teenager who's like this. That's the worst combination in the world. Grumpy old person plus teenager like this. It's just a bad combination. And then grumpy old person walks up and says, I want three and a half sugars, and I want it to be within 3 minutes, or I'm going to get even grumpier. And that's how they come up. And the teenagers are like, listen, I don't get paid enough for this. So they go back and they spit in the coffee, and then there's your coffee with 3 sugars and spit. That's what I get to witness. And the grumpy old person just yells at him. He said, let me see your manager. I see this almost every time I'm at McDonald's. Maybe I should go study somewhere else. Maybe not. I don't know. But people walk up and say, hey, I noticed you're studying the Bible. So I do it for that purpose also. It keeps me alert and it provides opportunities. You know what angers me the most about that situation? It's not the teenager. That's not what makes me angry. What makes me angry is a grumpy old person. Because what you don't know, grumpy old people, is what that teenager has at his home. One parent, maybe no parents, having to struggle to get by. They don't have what you have. And you walk up and they're trying to make ends meet and get paid. I'm a libertarian. So I don't want you to think I'm saying we should raise the minimum wage. Don't raise, that's not a solution. But what I'm saying is they're getting paid very little in comparison to what you have, grumpy old person. And then you're going up and making their day even worse. And this is what he's talking about. We live in ways sometimes where we cause children to be disheartened. And then you wonder why children are flocking away from the church. It's because how they were not raised properly and how we mistreated them. I don't look to them because they are still, if they're usually within their home under a teenage level, they're innocent. When I get up and I drive to the church building, you see on the softball field, the baseball field, children playing baseball on a Sunday morning. Every single child on that field is innocent. I'm not mad at those children. The ones who are not innocent are the parents up in the stands saying, yay, I took my child out of worshiping God to do this nonsense. That's what makes me angry. And so when he says in Colossians chapter 3, in verse 21, Father, provoke not your children to anger, lest they be discouraged. We can't dishearten the youth. That doesn't mean you can't correct them. The Proverbs writer says you don't stop disciplining a child because they cry. They're going to cry. No child. Always discipline. You don't stop disciplining because they cry. You discipline them in the Hebrews because you love them, Hebrew writer says. We had fathers in the flesh and they corrected us and we love them now because of that. But what we can't do is dishearten them. We want to encourage their heart. And listen, that involves love. When it says it puts others before self, it has to be genuine. You can't fake your love for your child. You can't fake it. They're going to pick up on it that you don't actually love them. And I hear stories about fathers coming home from work and then the children want nothing else but to see them. They haven't seen them all day. And then fathers come home from work and they plop down the recliner, turn on the television and say, don't bother me. You had these children. You committed to being a father. You committed to training these children. And what you're doing now is neglecting them. That's what you'll answer for. And you are disheartening them. That's what the Bible says. I would encourage you just not to have television. That'll prevent that. That's what the Hall House does. There's ways to prevent you acting like that if you struggle with it. We have to make sure we are putting others before ourselves. That includes your children that you brought into this world and made the decision. They didn't make the decision to come in this world. You did. So we cannot leave them spiritless or disheartened. Number three, love is not hypocritical. Love is not hypocritical. Wow, I'm really behind. Sorry. Love is not hypocritical. Look in Colossians 3, verse 22. Colossians 3, verse 22. Servants, obey in all things your masters according to the flesh, not with eye service as men pleasers. What does that indicate? It's the possibility in serving someone. You're just doing it to be seen. And Jesus dealt with this, didn't he? Just to be seen by men. Sometimes we do things just to be seen. He says, that is not what I'm talking about here. I'm talking about doing it because you genuinely actually mean what you're doing. You're not hypocritical. Hypocritical is saying one thing and doing another, or doing one thing and saying another. That's hypocrisy. Look at back in Romans chapter 12. Romans chapter 12. Go to verse 9. Romans 12 and verse 9. Let love be without dissimulation. That's hypocrisy. Love cannot go hand in hand with hypocrisy. So again, I tell the preaching students this, in my classes at least, I say you can't get up and fake that you mean it. I've seen preachers sometimes who, they write it down in their notes, pause for effect, open your eyes, shed a tear at this moment. You can't fake being genuine. And every person out in this audience knows you're just faking it. And I'll tell you one thing that is the fastest turn off for me is a fake in the pulpit. I'll just speak for myself. You can't fake being genuine. But what you can do is conduct your heart in such a way where you actually mean it. And if you actually mean it, you don't have to fake it. It's just going to come because you actually mean it. That's why we say you don't need to, as a preacher, become someone else. If you're becoming someone else, it's fake because that someone else is not you. Be yourself and be genuine. That's what he's talking about. Love is not hypocritical. Look in Colossians 3, verse 9. Colossians 3, verse 9. It demands that I speak the truth. It demands that I speak the truth because it's not hypocritical. Hypocrisy means I say one thing and do something else. And sometimes it's difficult to find it out until eventually you find out the fruit that, oh, they're saying one thing and meaning something entirely different. Because we can't know hearts, we can find it by the fruits. In Colossians 3, verse 9, lie not one to another, seeing that you have put off the old man with his deeds. I have to speak the truth to you. Sometimes the truth is not enjoyable, but I speak the truth and I don't lie to you because love is without hypocrisy. Now, I may not know immediately that you're lying to me. You may not know immediately that I'm lying to you. I could be the most wicked person in this room and be faking it to all of you. I could. Now, I'm going to go to hell for that, so I'm not going to sleep at night if I'm actually that way. But listen, I could be a fake, a complete phony. Hopefully people will start to catch on that if I'm a phony. But listen, I could be a fake and I can be a phony. You're not fooling God. And eventually, you won't be fooling man anymore. It demands I speak the truth with my brother, with my neighbor, with everyone. Ephesians chapter 4, verse 25. Ephesians 4, verse 25. He connects it to love. Wherefore, putting away lying, speak every man truth with his neighbor, for we are members one of another. Speak the truth with your neighbor, for we are members one of another. That goes to my relationship with one another. I speak the truth because my actions need to match my words. Number four, love demands the forgiveness of even the worst sins. Let's go to Ephesians 2. We'll go to Ephesians 2. Love demands the forgiveness of even the worst sins. Now, not the forgiveness of sins that have not been repented of, not the forgiveness of sins that have not been confessed, but the sins that have been repented of and confessed. I would go to Luke chapter 13 for that concept. It forgives the worst of them all. Love does. In 2 Corinthians chapter 2, if you go down with me to Ephesians chapter 2, go down with me to verse 4. Ephesians 2, verse 4. But God, who is rich in mercy for his great love, wherewith he loved us, here is his love being displayed. Even when we were dead in sins, he hath quickened us together with Christ. By grace are you saved. Why did God forgive us in our sins? Why? Because he loved us. Because he loved us. Love ties it all together. That was God's motivation for it. Why does God put up with John Hall day in, day out? Because he loves me. That's why. And so love demands the forgiveness of the worst sins. We need to do that for one another as well. As someone comes and repents of that sin, we forget it. We forgive it. God says in the book of Hebrews, he forgives and forgets. That doesn't mean our brain falls out of our head. Remember that Paul will readdress the fact that when Stephen was stoned, he was standing there consenting to it. Did his brain fall his head and now he forgot what he did to Stephen? No, he says, I was a part of it. But what Paul says in Philippians 3 is, I had to put those things behind me in order to press forward. So forgiveness means we move on. That's tied to love after that repentance takes place. And finally, I know we're out of time. Finally, love has always been expected of the Lord. In Colossians chapter 3, verse 24, Colossians 3, verse 24, knowing that of the Lord you shall receive the reward of the inheritance. It's expected of the Lord for my inheritance. For ye serve the Lord Christ. So it's always been expected by God. In fact, 1 Thessalonians 4 and verse 9 says, love is something that is taught. Sacrificial love is not something that's natural to a child. Watch a baby and you're not going to understand sacrificial agape love. You'll understand like dependence. They know where to go. But this, we're talking about agape sacrificial love, which is a mature love. It's commanded by God and it has to be taught. And this is exactly what Paul is doing in order to help the church at Colossae and Laodicea and all the churches so they are not going into what he's afraid they might be going into and giving into these temptations and sins around them. Got any time for questions or comments?
Yeah, 1 minute.
Is there 1 minute comment or question?
Hey, God, did you
yes, sir.
That the passage in Titus is for women to love their husbands is actually phileo and their own children.
Yeah.
Which is more of the ideal of, and sometimes when we say this, I'm not a friend of my child, but the Bible commands me to have that kind of love. That's the kind of love that they're teaching.
Yeah. There's an aspect of liking your children. And this is one thing that I've sometimes noticed with mothers is I also watch them make McDonald's and I start to think, I don't think you even like your children. And if I didn't already have four and a fifth one on the way, I'd say, give me your child because at least I'll like them. I didn't even give birth. I didn't give birth to any of my children. I wouldn't even have a part of that child and I'll like him more than you do. There has to be a genuine, I want this child because I actually want them. There's too many people who are willing to give that up. I think we're out of time. Thank y'all.